For the week of May 31st, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 281, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
And actually, we're going to be talking a lot about New York this week. Well, I mean, a lot of our news is coming out of New York this week.
All right, such as?
Well, on this week's show, we're going to be taking you to, or not you, Michael, since you were already there, but we're going to be taking our listeners to the Book Expo of America and BookCon. And these are the North American publishing industry's annual trade shows. Now, Michael, you were in attendance at the convention last week, so you're going to be telling us all about it. And I'm hoping that you're going to tell us the difference between the two shows.
I will.
Now, BEA and BookCon, as I mentioned, they're in New York City. So maybe we'll stick around the Big Apple for a bit, and we're going to find out how last year's Broadway productions fared at the box office. But we won't be staying in New York for the entire show. We'll get a little bit global on this week's show. For instance, we'll talk about how the unfolding FIFA corruption scandal will affect television deals around the world. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And while I fill you in on the worldwide box office, Sperling is going to look up San Andreas to see if he can find out how much of that movie's ticket sales or box office came from 3D.
40%. So, 40%. Really? No, I have no idea. I was just going to go with 40% and hope that I was somewhere near right. Yeah. By the way, if you want to know why I'm picking that number, stay tuned for the end of the show.
Well, we're looking at worldwide box office, of course. We get our info from RentTrak and a lot of other sources. You'll find links to RentTrak in our notes. And the number one movie around the world is, of course, Dwayne Johnson's San Andreas. $113 million. People like to see California be shaken by earthquakes.
Well, you know, if you go back to the 1970s, I could have told you that.
Disaster movies were big.
Yes. The funny thing is, like, I get, like, ridiculed all the time for not having seen, like, you know, Earthquake or
Towering Inferno.
Okay, I have seen the Towering Inferno, but I can't remember a thing. All those movies, those disaster movies, I kind of forget.
Well, they're forgettable, as is San Andreas, which did not get good reviews. But, you know, it's doing all right. It made more money overseas. It's in 61 territories. $53 million here in the U.S. is the number one film. $60 million in the rest of the world. So $113 million, a solid opening weekend for the movie. We'll have to see where it ends up.
By the way, you asked me about 3D for San Andreas.
Oh, you already got it.
At least here in North America, it was 44%. I was 4 points off.
Good guess. That's the new normal for 3D. We'll have to see if it ever lowers down.
I think it will.
That's where it stays.
I think it's going to be 30%. I've always said 30%.
All right. And number two around the world is Tomorrowland, the George Clooney film. This is not as doing as well as San Andreas. It made $43 million over the weekend. It's at $133 million worldwide. And it got middling reviews. It's kind of the worst kind of reviews. I mean, there are reviews where people go, I hate it, to the point where you go, gee, maybe I should go check out Aloha. Right. And there are reviews where they say, I love it. Where you go, gee, maybe I should go check out Mad Max Fury Road. But Tomorrowland, people just sort of shrug their shoulders.
Yeah, they're like, you know, you could see it on DVD and you would be missing nothing.
But you would be missing something if you didn't see Mad Max Fury Road in the theaters. One of the best reviewed movies of the year. Another $35 million. It's at $280 million and counting.
Now, what would I be missing? Because you said I'd be missing something, so I must...
Well, because it's a big spectacle, and I think no matter the great setups that people have on TV, even if you're watching it on Blu-ray, it's just not the same as seeing it in a movie theater. You know, it's a well-crafted film, according to most people, and it's worth seeing in a big movie theater with a big screen and great sound and great picture.
And now, if it happens to be on Broadway in New York City, then all the better.
Stand Mad Max the Musical. It'll happen. Stand By Me, Doraemon. That is a Japanese animated film. It made another $30 million. It's at $127 million. I guess it was reissued or something. I'm not sure what's going on here. It's only in one territory.
Japan.
Right. But I mean, it wasn't on the chart last week. But it's from 2014. It was one of the biggest hits of last year. Maybe they're reissuing it because school is out. Something like that. I'm not quite sure. It's based on a manga. It's about a little fourth grader named Nobita. And he gets bullied and he's unhappy and he sucks at school. And his future great-great-grandson is watching him from the future and sends back a robotic cat to help him and make sure things turn out all right so that his future great-great-grandson can, you know, exist. So that's the plot. It's adorable. It's delightful. It was a big hit. It's back in theaters and people are going to see it again.
Do any of these characters drive DeLoreans?
I guess they would have to. And number five is Avengers Age of Ultron, another $28 million. It's at $1.32 billion worldwide. And number six, Pitch Perfect 2. Will there be a Pitch Perfect 3? I guess, because this one made a lot of money.
Although they graduated. Didn't they graduate in this one?
Some of those characters. Some of them did, but you know, you carry on. One of them will become the mentor coach and the others will be new.
Yeah,
you know?
I think I can't remember who it was that was saying, well, now they should do like Pitch Perfect hip hop. Like the Step Up movies, those dance movies. They did like hip hop. They did tap dance. I can't remember.
I don't care what they do as long as they make a good movie because they haven't done that yet.
Oh.
But it made $25 million. It's at $230 million worldwide. Very, very successful. And number seven is Poltergeist, another $14 million. That's at just under $60 million worldwide. And number eight, one of the big debuts of the week. It wasn't a good one. It's Cameron Crowe's Aloha. It made $10 million here in North America. Wretched, wretched reviews, except I know somebody who loved it. They liked it. They liked it a lot. Our friend Aaron Rich, who's been on the show, he's like, I don't know what's going on. I'm the one person who liked it.
And he hated Mad Max, and he likes Aloha. You know what? It's the California sunshine. He moved to Los Angeles, and now look at what's
mind.
Exactly.
His brain has been fried.
He's practically a studio executive.
We'll come back to Aloha. No studio executive likes Aloha because it's not making money. We'll come back to that movie in a second. At number nine is Spy, the Melissa McCarthy film that's still out overseas before it opens up here, I think this weekend, right? It's got to be soon. It made $9 million. It's at $30 million and counting. And number 10 is Home, the DreamWorks animated film. 11 is PK. 12 is I, Frankenstein. This is a Hollywood movie that's been around for a while. It's the origin story of Frankenstein. And it's at $75 million worldwide. It opened somewhere and made $3 million.
I want to say it's probably China.
Right. Well, they didn't like it very much, did they? Unlike Furious 7, Fast and Furious 7, that made buku dollars in China. That's at $1.506 billion worldwide. And nowadays, when you look at the worldwide box office, every time they talk about a movie, they kind of mention whether it's opened in China yet.
That's
like
true.
San Andreas, I believe it did not open in China. But whatever happened, they would have made clear, yes, it's in China, or no, the China and Japan releases are still to come. That's almost a given now. They got to make clear because that could mean an extra $50, $100 million, $200 million, depending on the type of film it is.
Well, right. And I guess if it hasn't opened in China yet and it's made $1 billion, they're saying, you know, it's made $1 billion and it hasn't even opened in China yet.
Exactly.
Or if it's like Aloha, they can say, well, it only made $10 million, but it hasn't opened in China yet. So there are ways to spin the whole China opening that no matter which way you turn. And, you know, if you think that you know, we're not going to be seeing a lot of Chinese releases heading their way toward the Western world, think again. Because, Michael, you know that the Wanda Group, okay, the Wanda Dalian Group, they own AMC movie theaters here in North America, right?
That's right.
And they own, what is it, I can't, with 150 multiplexes in 80 different cities in China. Okay. They are, if they're not the world's largest movie theater exhibitor or movie exhibitor, then they certainly are well on their way to becoming that, especially now that they have, as of this morning, purchased Hoyts in Australia, which is one of Australia's largest movie theater chains.
It's just another step forward, right? Their globalization.
Yes. Well, and you know, when you have that kind of buying power, you know, if you're Wanda and you're turning to Sony and you're saying, so you got this next Spider-Man movie, you know, how do you want to sell this to us? Because you can sell to us for 3, 4, 5, 6 different territories. All of a sudden, you've got a lot of buying power. You become a Walmart, so to speak.
And that's true. But I always feel like that the studios have a lot of power when they have their next Spider-Man movie, they have their next Avengers movie. China wants it. I mean, Wanda wants it, right?
Yeah, well,
they want the movie. I mean, they've got, when you've got 4,000 screens to fill, you don't want to miss out on the biggest movie of the summer. So, at some point you become so big, you sort of really need, you know, that big product. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all. In fact, I would go so far as to say that Wanda is taking a page out of Hollywood's history book. And what I mean by that is they are buying all these movie theaters, right? And so they'll have, you know, 20,000 screens out of 100.
And they're making their own product.
And there you go. And so they're making their own product. And so they have this, they're building this huge studio in Qingdao, or I know I just butchered that, by the way. It's I think it's King Gao. Yeah. 30 sound stages, and they have you know, their own production companies, right, making.
So they want to be less dependent on Hollywood. They want to obviously make their own movie and put them in their own theaters and sell them in their own online system, you know, make money at every step of the way.
Right. They call that vertical integration, which was outlawed in the movie business in 1948, thanks to the Paramount Decree, which also, by the way, makes block booking illegal. And what I mean by that is if you're, well, in this case, Disney, you would not be allowed to say, well, if you don't play, you know, XYZ film,
you don't show Tomorrowland, you're not going to get Inside Out
or The Avengers or Star Wars. You can't do that, right, at least not in North America. You might be able to do that in other countries, probably not Europe, but you can't do that in North America.
So until Wanda has their own supply of movies, and even when they do, they're still going to want Star Wars.
Yes, absolutely.
So, right? So, I mean, I know they're bigger and therefore they should have more power, but I still feel like, hey, you know, you shouldn't be giving up, you know, you should push them to, you know, you should push everybody to get closer to the 50% you get in North America. How did they get away with that? How come the rest of the world gets 30, 35% cut? You know, the studios get a much lower cut of what the box office is than they do compared to North America.
Well, again, keep in mind that for years, what happened was, you know, that the studios would make the film, they'd keep the North American rights and maybe some territorial rights in English language speaking territories, Australia, maybe United Kingdom, Canada, maybe Japan. But then they were actually, Japan, they would usually sell off. They would sell off the rights in all of these other, the distribution
rights. The local companies.
Right. And so they would get only a certain percentage based on what they sold the rights for. Now, more and more, and this is why in certain territories, I think it was Furious 7, there was some pushback in, maybe it wasn't Furious 7, maybe it was Avengers. I can't.
Germany?
In Germany, yes. About, you know, they, you know, the studio wanted 53% of the box office. This was unheard of. Well, more and more, the studios are saying, you know, before we didn't care because it wasn't our movie at that point in your territory. Now it's our movie in your territory, and we want 50%.
So does Wanda own any theaters in Mexico?
I do not know. I know Cinepolis does, of course. They're a huge exhibitor and chain. They have a few theaters here in the U.S. that are all like high-end luxury cinemas. Cinepolis is the largest movie theater owner in Latin America, certainly, but Mexico, definitely.
So hopefully they were showing this new film?
Oh, this new film, you're talking about Gueros, right? Which is,
that's correct.
This is the big winner. I hate doing this, but it's Mexico's Academy Awards. That's the way the Hollywood Reporter billed it. And these are the Ariel Awards, which were held last Wednesday night. And
and this is a debut film for Alonso Ruiz Palacio. I'm saying it like an Italian for some reason, but there you go.
I think it's Ruiz Palacios.
Palacios, there you go.
Yes,
Ruiz Alonso Palacios.
Now, please, if you would like to write in and tell us how much we've butchered, let's see, Chinese, and I'm sure we've butchered some other language, but now we've butchered Spanish. Feel free, dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263.
Yeah, and, you know, wish us aloha.
Oh, you know what? We're on fire today. We're speaking all sorts of different languages, first of all, and we're just able to whip through these stories playing one off the other. Now, you're talking about aloha, not the Hawaiian word, okay, which has many different meanings in
right. Everybody, I think, knows that, like, shalom, it means hello and goodbye and peace, or, you know, I mean, that there's multiple meanings of that, but I think everyone knows aloha can mean both hello and goodbye.
And compassion and mercy and grace. And the Cameron right. Crowe film starring Bradley Cooper, Rachel McAdams, and Emma Stone released in 2015.
Right. And some people people were already mentioning, hey, it looks like there are almost no Hawaiians in the film. They're only in the background in tiny little scenes. It looks like all white people, even though the vast majority, you know, Hawaiians are, you know, Hawaiian. And they're angry about that. Now they're angry just even about the title.
Yes, that's right. They're saying, you know, if you have a romantic comedy, and this was said by, Walter Ritt, a native Hawaiian activist on the island of Molokai. He said, if you have a romantic comedy about the military in Hawaii, .. but a title that says aloha, I can only guess that they'll bastardize the word. They're taking our sacred word and they're going to make a lot of money off of it. Well, guess what, Walter? You don't have to worry about the latter part. They took your word. They're not making a lot of money off of it.
I have to say, I appreciated the comments about Hawaiian actors and how you're, you know, setting a movie in Hawaii and there are very few Hawaiians visible in it, and the disparity of that and how that's wrong and silly. It's just like making a movie in Harlem and there'd be no black people in it. Though nowadays Harlem is so gentrified that black people are being pushed out of it.
But I was just going to say, so basically that would be a modern day story in Harlem. Yeah.
But you know, the tagline of the movie was, sometimes to say hello, first you have to say goodbye, which is, you know, this guy is trying to end one relationship, you know, acknowledge that one relationship has ended. It's over. It's already been over. And then maybe he'll be open to a possibility of new romance. So that certainly captures at least some of what Aloha. It's not, let's just a random, oh, let's just put Aloha on the title. At least there is some sense of hellos and goodbyes in the plot of the movie. And I'm, you know, it just doesn't seem to me that disrespectful. If anybody ever references Hawaii, you immediately think Aloha.
Right.
You know, that is not, I mean, that's, you know, something to be proud and happy of. The whole world recognizes Aloha. And if you can educate them about the rich meanings of that word, great and wonderful. But, you know, a movie or a song, you know, Aloha Hawaii, golly, you know, there must be 10,000 tourism posters and 10,000 books and 10,000 songs and things that offend you. If referencing Hawaii by using the word Aloha makes you angry, you must be very angry all the time.
That's probably true. And you know, when I...
Yeah, I think there are better battles to pick. I think the battle about, you know, setting a movie in Hawaii and keeping Hawaiians invisible when they are a majority of the population is very valid and a good point to make, and to encourage people when they're making movies there to actually cast Hawaiian actors and give them roles and visibility to actually reflect the world you're in. That makes sense. But getting angry about the title of the movie being Aloha and saying it's disrespectful? Well, guy, my gosh, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny when there was that big, not dispute, but kind of those stories about, well, they didn't cast enough Hawaiians. You know, it's a film filled with, you know, Caucasian people. I said, so it's, you know, having been to Hawaii a couple times, it's kind of like being in Hawaii. Because if you go to Hawaii, it's a place filled mostly with, non-Hawaiian people.
No, that's and the population is like, I think, 40% native.
Right. But but when you go there, you don't, you know.
Well, when you stay in your hotel. And
yes.
Well, that's you. But the actual population.
That was actually. Yeah. And that's, I'm kind of trying to riff off of what The Rock did when he played, like a Hawaiian waiter on a Saturday Night Live skit.
According to the U.S. Census, Native Hawaiian and other Pacific Islander alone represent about 10%. Two or more races is 23%. I mean, there's like the whole world, you know, this cultural construct of race, everything blends together, blah, blah, blah. But white alone is about 26%. So, you know, Asian alone, 37%. So, yeah, you're looking at a vast majority of the population. 75% is non-white.
Okay.
You know, so if you're looking at a movie and 95% of everyone is white, whatever your personal experience was when you hid in your hotel room, that doesn't reflect.
I didn't hide in the hotel room. I'm just saying.
Where do you think Bladder is hiding? Because we're going to talk about FIFA now.
Oh, we are. We're not gonna find out whether we're ever going to see this movie, Gueros. Okay. I don't even know what this movie is.
Gueros is playing in film form right now in America. So.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, today's the last day. It's been playing there for a week or two.
And it won all these awards. Okay, well, then I'm going to have to fly to New York and see it. Certainly, I've missed Book Expo of America, which we'll talk about later.
So why are we talking about FIFA? It's football. It's soccer. It's a sport. What does that have to do with the entertainment world that we cover?
Well, because now, if you follow me here, okay, we're talking about this because Tom Brady deflated the ball before the big cup of bowl that he had to play in February or January, whenever that thing was. And that's why we're talking about it, because there was a big football scandal. He deflated the ball a little bit so he could throw it better, right?
That's he did not deflate it. Others deflated it.
But for him.
For
supposedly.
The team, yes.
Supposedly. Yes. Okay.
Whether he actually knew is debatable, but the football has ruled that he would have been aware of it and therefore needed to pay a penalty and has been suspended from several games.
And here's a whole multi-million dollar fine as well. And by the way,
what the hell is? Why did you get on this? Why are we talking
about this?
Talk about TV deals for FIFA and soccer.
Well, skip to FIFA. And you said that the team has a history of cheating, the New England Patriots. Well, guess what? FIFA has a history of corruption.
Oh, my God, to say the least.
I mean, when I heard that, oh, there's like some scandal about the corruption last week when this started breaking, I thought to myself, wait, is this a new one or an old one? Because right. I can't keep my FIFA corruption scandal straight.
So it will impact a lot of things. It impacts TV deals all over the world, which affects, you know, programming and money for everybody. And that's, you know, a lot of the major studios are tied into TV networks. And same thing with countries overseas. So you've got Fox, you've got, you know, everybody is involved in soccer now. And so that really impacts leagues. It impacts Disney, ABC, it impacts Fox, you know, it impacts everybody. And all those TV deals and things are involved with the money and the soccer scandal. So it impacts
and
them.
And the scandal, we should say, is basically everybody a whole bunch of people getting bribed to for various reasons. It's not
it's
the least
the
of
latest
which.
Scandal. Soccer is as corrupt as it comes for many reasons.
Whether it's match fixing or the you know, favoritism, or hey, please place the World Cup in my territory, because you know what? Nothing says you should be playing soccer here in Qatar than 120 degree heat. you know, that in and of itself, for the 2022 World Cup, when Qatar got it, everybody kind of raised their eyebrows and said, okay, let's start checking bank accounts.
And right. So it impacts the sponsors who are associated with soccer. We're going to call it that from now. It impacts, of course, Hollywood, because they are associated with countries like Qatar and other places in the UAE. They have deals with them. They have studios set up there. Hollywood stars go there all the time and treat, you know, Dubai and the UAE and Abu Dhabi and all these places like they're wonderful playgrounds, when in fact they're, you know, governments that are denounced by the UN and Amnesty International as, you know, hellish, terrible countries that people should be ashamed to visit, much less go and promote as if they're a delightful place to, you know, spend your holiday. And now that soccer is going there, they're going to Qatar, they're going to Russia, which has a terrible human rights record and is getting worse. Now Europe may boycott the Russian World Cup because they know it was bought with bribes. The Qatar one is a joke. It's being built with slave labor. The stadiums being built are literally being built by people who are dying, who are not allowed to go home. There's an earthquake in Nepal, and they refuse to let the workers leave the country and go home because they've taken their passports and they won't let them go anywhere.
But
they
don't, you know, pay them. The Qatarians, if that's how you, you know, yes, say the name of the citizens of Qatar, they would say, aren't we all really dying at some point?
Sports stars flock to these countries, you know, and they support these countries and the corruption that happens because of them. Celebs go there. There are film and music festivals there. NYU has a campus there in the UAE. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And so the World Cup scandal with this FIFA can, in fact, have an impact on all those film festivals and music festivals and studio deals and Hollywood celebrities who go to get play checks, Tiger Woods and Roger Federer, sports stars who show up and say, oh, I'll play tennis in your country. Give me $1 million. Absolutely. Oh, it's a wonderful place.
Now, is Abu Dhabi, which is where the NYU campus is that part, is the UAE a confederation of states, or actually Abu Dhabi is the capital of the United Arab Emirates? So I just answered my own question. But okay, so yes, they're all going to the UAE, a lot less so to Abu Dhabi, because they just canceled their film festival after 8 years.
They did cancel their film festival because I felt like they probably got everything they could out of it. You know,
yeah.
I'm not sure what pushed them to do that, but they still have other, you know, lots of other cultural outreach and things that go on.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know how we got on that. Probably.
I mean, Qatar is a sovereign Arab country. I associate all those minor despotic countries around the UAE and Qatar with one another. Sorry, Middle East, but I do.
You know, all those countries look alike.
Yeah, and you're holding
all flattened
a World
on
Cup
the map.
You're holding a World Cup in a country where Jews are not welcome, where gays are not welcome, where if a woman is raped, she'll be thrown in jail if she complains about it. Because if you're raped, that means you're a whore, and therefore you get thrown in jail. And that's not an exaggeration. So the FIFA and Hollywood and sports world, all these people perfectly happy to look the other way. And now there's a little scandal and suddenly people are saying, wow, golly, maybe we shouldn't have the World Cup in Qatar, you know, and that's going to impact a lot of deals for years to come if we're lucky.
Do you think a part of this, if you're
and
lucky,
then we just got news, of course, that Blatter has resigned. Everybody will know that by the time this goes up. But in fact, the head of FIFA, who's been the head of this corrupt institution for a long, long time, has finally stepped down. My guess is that they said, we'll reelect you, but then you got to leave.
Well, Sepp Blatter was always very smart in the way he looked at the world and said, you know what? I could go out to all these powerful football countries like Italy and France and England and try and get their votes. But the reality is they're very expensive to buy. to buy.
So he goes to the cheaper countries that love corruption.
Well, and he went to the cheaper countries, to the more impoverished countries, and he said, you know what? I can get like 20 of those countries, put a team up here, put a stadium up there, and they'll love me. And all of a sudden, I'll get 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 votes because every vote counts. It doesn't matter whether it comes from Trinidad and Tobago or whether it comes from France. It's all just one vote. So he was very smart in that. And even in the midst of this huge corruption scandal, he gets reelected.
Yeah. So do you think this will actually have a big, long-lasting impact, or more likely, will a few people have to roll and things will continue back the way they were?
I think, you know, much like the performance-enhancing drug debacle in Major League Baseball, I think a few heads will roll, some things will change a bit, but ultimately it's a cycle that will repeat itself. Just look 3-4 years later, we still have players in baseball, Major League Baseball, being suspended for using performance-enhancing drugs. I think the same thing will be true here. When there is that much money to go around, there is always somebody trying to figure out a way to put it in their own pocket. The only thing that would change that is if Visa and all of these big sponsors say, you know what, we can't associate ourselves with you anymore. We're taking our names off of this, and you can go and you can still hold your events and everything, but we're not going to be a part of it. Then that would change, you know, that would have to change everybody's tune, because there wouldn't be that money there for people to try and be corrupt around.
And then we could turn it into a Broadway musical. Andrew Lloyd Webber tried to make a musical out of soccer called The Beautiful Game.
Oh,
didn't work.
I can't imagine why.
Was Andrew Lloyd Webber? Was it Ben Elton? I'm suddenly forgetting. Maybe Andrew Lloyd Webber did something on cricket.
Well, I don't know. I mean, do you think that any of these, I know that we're trying to move on to Broadway, but let me ask you this. Do you think that, I mean, the big thing here and why we're talking about it is all these TV deals, right? Do you think that, I mean, it's not like, certainly for the Brazil games, which were held last year in 2014, it's not like any of the licensees, the broadcasters could go and say, well, there was all this corruption, we want some money back, because everybody watched the event. So they got their money's worth, right?
Absolutely.
So wouldn't that be true of the World Cup in Russia? Unless people boycott it, I suppose.
Well, but the Europeans boycott and say, no, you can't buy, you know, the right to have the World Cup in your country. We want to fight corruption and we hate Russia. That's probably part of the Western European attitude, you know, to hell with them. You know, and Qatar was a joke from the start. That was as corrupt and ridiculous as it comes. So they're going to say, no, you can't just buy the right to have the World Cup in your country. If you have it there, we won't go. That'll have an impact.
You know, I didn't understand why Vladimir Putin, of course, the head of Russia, the president of
Russia,
czar, basically, why he was like, oh, the U.S. should stay out of the FIFA mess. You know, they're just trying to get at me, you know. And I thought, well, you know, Mr. Putin, with all due respect, not everything is about you. But I kind of neglected to remember that the World Cup is going to be in Russia in 2018 because I was so focused on Qatar in 2022 that I forgot. Oh, yeah, they are kind of messing with him, I suppose.
Well, and they love their corruption. So any chance to go nose to nose with the U.S. is a good one. But yes, I was right. The Beautiful Game was a musical by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Ben Elton, a musical about soccer on stage. Didn't work.
Yes. Well, maybe that's because, you know, Andrew Lloyd Webber didn't pay the corruption money.
That's right.
It'd be a shame if anything happened to your little play.
Okay. Moving on to Broadway.
No, come on. That was my really poor Russian accent. Look, we've already botched Spanish and Chinese. We're moving east or west or whichever direction we're headed. I'm sure your country will be next and we will try and pronounce words in your dialect. Poorly, of course. Speaking of which, Broadway has its own dialect, and it's mostly percentages in box office.
And Tony Awards. We're a week away from the Tony Awards. They'll be taking place on Sunday, June 7th, which is the date for our next podcast. So that we're looking forward to that. And Broadway finally has the figures on 2014. Their season runs from like May of 2014 to May of 2015. There are specific days in there, but it's basically an annual thing, and it ends in May.
Well, attendance was up.
That's how the year runs. What?
Attendance
absolutely.
Is up. 7%. Well, no. Yeah, no, both attendance and grosses are up. Sometimes grosses are up and attendance is flat or down because ticket prices rose and, you know, less people went, but they paid more. So, you know, at the end of the day, everything went up 7%.
Yeah, so that's great news for Broadway. You know, they're charging more and more people are still going. More people attended a Broadway show in this year than attended all 10 professional New York and New Jersey sports teams combined. So all the games of the Yankees and the Mets and the Giants and the Jets, all these people all together did not add up to how many people went to a Broadway show.
Now, let's look at the winning seasons of all the teams you just mentioned. The New York Mets, the New York Yankees. Well, actually, the Yankees did.
The Brooklyn, whatever.
Nets. And yeah, I mean, they didn't all have good years.
No, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, football, baseball, basketball, hockey, all them combined.
In all fairness, the Rangers made it to the New York Rangers made it to the Stanley Cup. So,
yes, they did. And some shows made it to the winner's circle as well. The Lion King grossed $102 million. It was the biggest show on Broadway, you know, 20 years or whatever into its run, 15 years into its run. It set a single season record, $102 million. This show is grossing like $2 million a week. And they have it down to a science. They are really good at maximizing their money. And they don't charge the absolute top dollar for tickets, but they just know they're getting families in, people bringing two kids, three kids, and they know with that group sales and having a great experience that they'll come back again. They'll tell other people to go, and it's working. Number two was Wicked, $91 million. Number three was The Book of Mormon at $84 million. And finally, a newer show, Aladdin, grossed $76 million. I had opened a season ago, but it grossed $76 million, along with Beautiful, which grossed $61 million, and Kinky Boots, which grossed $60 million, and finally Matilda. So you've got some fresh blood in there. Matilda made just over $50 million for that season, for that year, from May to May. May of 2014 to May of 2015. All those shows made $50 to $100 million. There's three or four big new ones in there. Aladdin is really tearing it up. That keeps growing. That really looks like it is going to be a long, long-running hit. It'll be yet another big success story for Disney on Broadway.
So let's look at this for a second, because it just goes to show you how important the Tony Awards are. For instance, you look at Kinky Boots. Now, okay, I never would have thought that play or that musical would still be on Broadway.
Nor would I, because I didn't like it.
And it won the Tony Award. Now it's, you know, it's what, second, third year? It's
It was doing great. It was doing great from the day it opened.
Okay.
I mean, from first preview, that sucker, that was not a show that was turned around by the Tony Awards. That certain validation absolutely helps it, I'm sure. Long term, people have that extra security. Oh, that won the Tony for Best Musical. But something like A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, that's run for more than a year. And that is all completely due to the Tonys. So that's a show that was turned around by the Tonys. Kinky Boots definitely wanted and needed and could use that validation. Matilda is right behind it. That was the one that it beat out for the Tony.
That's right.
And that's still running as well. Matilda's doing slightly better in the weekly grosses right now, but I think Kinky Boots has made more money. You can see it made an extra $10 million, $9 million this year. So Kinky Boots is winning the financial war. Matilda may last a little bit longer on Broadway. We'll have to see where it ends up. But, you know, you can do well with or without the Tony. But Kinky Boots, from day one, the second it opened in previews, it was doing great. Just like this season where we have An American in Paris. We had a lot of new shows this year, and An American in Paris, from day one, was the hit. Who knows why? I don't know. But that was just doing great. So is Finding Neverland, which did not get nominated for a Tony. But An American in Paris, I think, will win the Tony for Best Musical. And A Curious Incident for the Dog, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, that will win Best Play. And that's been the best performing play. A lot of times you'll see the Tony go to the show that is the most popular. That happens a fair amount of time.
Gee, that never happens like in, say, I don't know, the Grammy Awards.
That's true. A lot of times big albums will get nominated for Album of the Year. They don't always win, but, you know, you certainly have those iconic albums like Thriller wins and, you know, Adele 21. And I mean, those things happen. Absolutely.
Well, you know, Matilda is out here right now in Los Angeles. It's playing at the Amundsen Theater. And on Saturday, I had some friends who went to see it, and the show was delayed by an hour because I guess there's so much electronics and machinery that.
Oh, but that shouldn't happen. Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, my gosh, all those kids sitting there for an hour.
Oh, yeah.
And yet, apparently, it eventually went off, but it was a little delayed. But
did they have fun? What did they say?
They liked it. They enjoyed it. But, you know, $51 million still on Broadway. They got the touring show going. You know, really, when you start looking at these shows, you got The Lion King from a movie, Aladdin from a movie, Kinky Boots from a movie. Matilda was a book, right? So we can't exactly.
And a movie.
But, you know, these are known entities.
Wicked is from a book.
True. You're right.
Book of Mormon is original.
Yes.
Aladdin is a movie. Beautiful is original.
Original, but based on somebody's life or at least their music, right?
Right, but it's an original Broadway musical.
Okay.
I mean, it's an original show. It's not based on a movie or a book.
True. Okay.
So, you know, not too Kinky Boots based on a film. So there you go.
So what you're saying, I mean, look, at the end of the day, you're making $50 million on Broadway, which is something that, I don't know, off the top of my head, the producers of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, they couldn't do.
And well, they made money. It just cost more to run it.
Yeah.
You know, it was so much to mount that they ended up not making any money, despite running for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Audiences came. It just, the show was too expensive to ever make its money back. You know, you look at this, you spend an entire year and you make $100 million. Well, if your movie costs $300 million to make, you're going to have to run for, you know, 6 years before you make your money back.
And by movie, you mean musical, but okay.
No, movie. I'm saying, like, yeah, if your movie or musical, you know, if your movie makes $300 million, costs $300 million to make, you're going to have to make $900
million. Right.
So Lion King made $100 million this year, but that's gross. That's not profit. You know, it costs about $600,000, $700,000 a week to run that.
So they basically earned a 60%, so they made $40 million.
Yeah, they made over $1 million a week. So they probably made more like 55, maybe even close to 60 million, but probably more like $57 million in profit.
Yeah, well, that's significant.
That's pretty damn great. Yeah,
that's significant.
Absolutely.
Some might even
say, it's a big deal.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, some might call that a big deal, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. By the way, Michael, do you think our audience at this point, anybody listening to the show, do you think they're getting whiplash? Because we're going through these stories so quickly.
Not when you talk about it so much.
Oh, okay. Well, then I should probably just move on to our first Big Deal or Big Whoop story, which is about TLC, 19 and Counting. You know the show that's on there. TLC was taking it slowly after the child molestation scandal rocked its Bible Belt family values reality show, 19 and Counting. They yanked repeats, but held off on a decision about the fate of the series as a whole. Kind of
maybe
like,
we'll just get rid of the child molester.
Yeah.
That seems to be their current thinking.
It's like Sepp Blatter. I'm going to get reelected and then see how things go. advertisers may be deciding the fate of the show for them, by the way. So far, more than a dozen have demanded TLC yank their ads from the show in the future. Among the companies who figure it's probably not a good idea to be found in such a divisive environment are Ace Hardware, Pizza Hut, Allstate Insurance, and Walgreens. In addition, Hulu has dropped the show from its lineup. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'd say it's a big deal, but the Hollywood Reporter just had a story saying, well, yeah, but, you know, they didn't yank their money from TLC. They just said, don't put it on that show. And all they really did was release a press release saying we don't want to be associated with it. And they get the good, you know, value of saying, oh, look, we have standards and we're, you know, moral and we don't want to be associated with this show. And we reap all the good publicity for that. But that still has to have an impact, doesn't it? Sure, they're keeping their ads and going to be on. They're saying TLC won't change its, you know, tawdry nature, you know, with Honey Boo Boo and 19 and Counting. But this show in particular, you know, if nobody wants to advertise on the show, you're going to be making less money. It's not going to be worth running, right?
It's like nobody watched it. Therefore, no advertisers wanted to support it. Therefore, we had to cancel it.
People keep watching it. Yeah. Right. And they're thinking right now, it seems to be maybe we can keep the show going, but we'll just keep the guy who is a child molester off.
Yeah.
And people keep writing about it, saying the alleged, it's not alleged. He confessed. He did it. It's not
allegedly
alleged anymore.
He confessed.
He said it. I did it. So, you know, you don't have to say alleged. He's a child molester.
Michael will be running down the street pointing his finger at you while you walk down the street. Okay, well, maybe TLC can take a few lessons.
If you're going to shame anyone, surely a child molester is the one it should be.
Okay.
Not that I'm into Scarlet Letters, but good God.
You'll have to be the Scarlet Letter. Again, you'll be following him around with your pointer finger.
Okay.
TLC, as I was saying, could probably learn a few things from China. The government is in the midst, and the government of China, that is in the midst of a morals campaign, and reality TV is taking the big hit. Reality TV is so popular in China that a number of shows have been spun off into feature films. My goodness, that's never happened in the U.S. before.
Jackass.
Or, come on, you can do it. It's an American Idol film.
Kelly and Justin.
Yeah. But now the government, the Chinese government again, is insisting each channel can only air one reality show a year. And these shows would literally close.
American networks are literally weeping. They're like, oh my God. They can't do that here, can they?
Could you imagine?
Oh, my God.
Well, according to the Chinese government, the reality shows that air must be, quote, close to the masses with no exaggeration and no mixing the spurious with the genuine. First of all,
clearly, they don't know what reality TV is about.
Yes. You have a whole bunch of network executives looking up the word spurious. Okay.
And spurious mixed with genuine is our wheelhouse.
Exactly. Well, so is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal for the channels in China. It's not a morals campaign so much as a we want to control everything about your life campaign. And I guess reality television is showing people of me. When they say close to the masses, I guess they say we don't want to see all these people that others are going to aspire to be like with wealthy and happy lifestyles. And maybe they're going to be encouraging more capitalism and more, aspirational life and, thinking for themselves. And I don't know what they're worried about, but clearly they find some threat in reality television as it airs in China. So it's kind of interesting that they would find it so disturbing. Normally you see these sort of things as bread and circuses, something that distracts people from their life. Oh, you've got a miserable life. Well, watch Honey Boo Boo and laugh at them. I mean, that's really the point of those shows, as awful as it is to say that, that's what's happening. Watch Duck Dynasty and laugh at those loony bins, those crazy nutty guys farting in their camper as they run around making duck calls,
Is that what goes on in that show? I had no idea.
Absolutely. So China, for some reason, they see it as more of a threat than more of a pacification. It's kind of interesting.
Well, I just wonder, right now Kim Kardashian is saying, what does this mean for us?
As long as she's doing just fine.
Film composers, they're not.
And didn't Caitlyn look damn good? But anyway.
Okay, it's funny. I brought Kim Kardashian's name up, and I thought to myself, why did I do that? Because Michael is going to have to mention.
When my mother says, oh, did you see? I'm like, of course, the whole world saw it. Even if I didn't want to see it, I saw it.
And the funny thing is, we don't even have to mention what it is.
And bless her heart, my mother, not the most, progressive liberal person in the world, She referred to Bruce Jenner as Caitlyn and as she. She sort of caught herself. Well, as she, I'm like, oh, isn't that? I mean, that's a new world. When your parent is like being careful about their gender choice because they're trying to be respectful.
There was a, not to get off on this topic of basically what we're referring to here is the Vanity Fair cover with Bruce Jenner, who is now transgender, appearing as a woman named Caitlyn Jenner. Her new identity.
Just like my mom did. Well done.
On the front cover. First of all, a couple things. One, media related. The cover is what's called a poster cover in magazine publishing, where there's no cover speak. There's no cover lines where, you have, on page 60, how to get a better beard, grow a better beard, or whatever it is.
It's just the image.
It's just the image.
Shot by Annie Leibovitz, the great photographer.
With, of course, the name of the magazine. That's something from the 50s and 60s, Life magazine type stuff. Saturday Evening Post type of graphic design. That said, there was a debate I saw on Facebook between, two former guests, actually. The first of whom I'll just leave nameless, and they're not former guests who have been on in the past. Who was kind of decrying the fact that everybody was talking about this and the fact that, Caitlyn Jenner was even on the front cover of Vanity Fair and why it is we were actually, kind of glorifying something that was a very private affair for Bruce Jenner and now Caitlyn Jenner. And Alonzo Duraldo, Duraldi. Yeah, I knew as I was saying that, I was like, I think it's Duraldi, not Duraldo. But he is a film critic and an entertainment journalist who's been on the program a number of times here. He's written a book or two on the, about movies. He works for The Wrap now, if I'm not mistaken. And he said, you know what? I hated Will and Grace, and I wasn't a big fan of the show. But what that show did for gay, lesbian, the LGBT community was absolutely amazing. It really turned things around. So if this, if Caitlyn Jenner being on the front cover of Vanity Fair can do the same for the transgender population, then as much as I'm not a big fan of promoting that this type of stuff because it is private, then so be it. And I thought that was probably the best comment I read about it.
Well, Caitlyn Jenner's not trying to be private, of course.
No, I mean,
and what a life! That'll be a movie. I wonder. I mean, really, that's an amazing life. Can't say Caitlyn, took it easy and didn't do much.
That's true, but I do wonder who will compose the music for it, because whoever it is, they won't be happy. First music composer. You see how what I did there? I brought it right back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I love the fact that we're actually self-referential today. At least I am. Film composers are not happy, Michael, and not just in general. First they sued for recording too many film scores overseas to save money.
They sued studios.
Yeah, they sued because, you're recording that soundtrack, that score in Bulgaria or Romania again.
Well, they have rules about how many scores can be done overseas and how many need to stay within the U.S. so that their members get work.
Right. They have an agreement with the American Federation of Musicians. Now they're suing, the composers are, they're suing multiple studios for reusing film scores over and over and over again in other movies. The score for The Taking of Pelham 123 pops up repeatedly, and the score for Titanic appears here and there and, well, frankly, everywhere. And they're not paying for these pieces of music, sometimes running as long as 2 or 3 minutes long. Some of these cues are pretty extensive. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I mean, at first I thought the story was illustrated by a picture of Jaws. You know, the poster from the movie Jaws. And I thought, oh, well, you know, movies, of course, use that as a joke or whatever. Do they think it, you know, is it fair use? Or what are they just talking about, that sort of thing where you're quoting and listen, you know, playing a little piece of music from Titanic as you make fun of a scene where people mimic that scene? No, but they're talking about just like lifting pieces of score and using it in other movies, like, which to me doesn't even, like, why are they bothering? I'm guessing that it's on the temp track.
That's you're absolutely
the scene,
right.
And it just gets left in because they're like, oh, I love it. So I just keep it.
Yes, you're absolutely 100% correct. What winds up happening is some editor somewhere will say, crud, we have a music cue here and we don't have the music yet. You know what? Go get me the...
They never have the music yet because they got to edit it before they can create a score 90% of the time.
Right. And so they'll put some temp work in and the filmmaker and the creatives fall so in love with that music that they're like, you know what? That it actually works. And now...
But why aren't they paying for it?
They do pay to license that music, but they don't pay, they're paying the publisher, they're paying the studio.
They're saying they're not paying. They're saying they're supposed to pay and they're not. So even if they're paying for some of their legal obligations, they're not paying for all of them.
They're not paying the composer, who's really
they should.
Well, no, they're paying whoever the composer got paid already to compose that music. Okay, and that music is now owned by somebody else. So they're paying
the composer. You never know.
Yeah, it depends.
John Williams? I don't know.
Yeah, in many cases, it's the studio or the publisher that owns the...
Well, they're claiming that they're not paying someone they're supposed to legally be paying. They're not saying it would be nice if you paid me. They're saying you're supposed to be paying. You're stealing this music. They're not saying, oh, we need to come up with new rules. They're saying you're stealing this music and you're not paying for it the full amount that you should.
Well, that's They should sue.
Absolutely.
And they are, actually.
I think it's a big deal.
Okay. Well, NBC... doesn't want to fire Brian Williams because they still have to pay him a ton of money. Okay?
Unlike those film composers. Guys come cheap.
Yeah, apparently you don't even have to pay him. But NBC Nightly News is, you know, they're doing okay without Brian Williams. So, you know, now NBC is trying to figure out some new role they can give Williams without putting him back in the anchor chair. Brian Williams, as you know, he's tainted from delivering the news there, but not too tainted to do news stories for, say, NBC News and Dateline and in primetime specials, maybe. I don't know. Does that make any sense? Big deal or big whoop?
I got a little confused there, but no, it doesn't. If you've decided he's damaged goods, then you shouldn't be using Money Network at all. But, you know, all the stories we heard as we caught our breath and looked at what happened, it seemed like the accusations and things thrown against him did not hold a lot of water.
No, I mean, was basically, you know.
We talked about he was pretty consistent for many years and that the wording and what actually happened was closer to what he said than what the people would accept, you know. And so it did not sound like the whole. So the first thing is to release the report. And they've talked about, oh, he has to go on air and be interviewed by Tom Brokaw and throw himself on his sword and say how sorry he is and, you know, how wrong he was. Well, I mean, what actually happened? I mean, if the report says it wasn't that bad, I'm not sure what else happened that they suddenly think, oh, they can't unless they're just bowing to public pressure. So I don't understand it.
The public pressure that they themselves seem to,
have created. Yeah. Yeah. It just, I'm not sure what's going on or why. All I know is now they owe him a lot of money. And if he's smart, the last thing he'll want to do is like go to Dateline or like do some occasional special. He'll just say, thank you, I'll go somewhere else. Because if they pointed to Ann Curry when she was kicked off the Today Show, and she hung around NBC and she was a major talent. Well, they just sort of didn't do much with her. And suddenly 2, 3, 4 years later, she's ready to move on and she doesn't have the same oomph that she used to have. And I think Brian Williams would be smarter to say, yeah, you know what? I'm going to move on.
Yeah. And he'll say, I'll take the money and he can do anything he wants at that point.
Right.
Now, special effects and makeup genius Rick Baker, he's won 7 Academy Awards, but now at the age of 64, he is retiring.
That seems young. I don't know why. It's not. I guess it's young in the new world we live. But, you know, that used to be the age of retirement. You're like, he's only 64.
But, you know, not when you see Mick Jagger strutting around the stage at 71.
Exactly.
Now, make that he's not really retiring. OK, he's really quitting, since Hollywood wants everything cheap and fast. And while, you know, Baker, he's known for liking to do things right. I mean, this is a guy that would take Jim Carrey and put him in a chair and say, all right, you're going to be here for like the next 10 days as I put this makeup on you for this 2-minute scene. You know, his work includes An American Werewolf in London, Ed Wood, Men in Black. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop. I mean, it's not going to change anything. Hollywood's not going to start doing things differently. They're not going to be shamed by Rick Baker like they should be. So it's a bummer. I mean, there should be somebody somewhere who's willing to use Rick Baker and let him do the work he can do for the money he deserves and at the pace that will make it good. You know, I mean, what's the point of using Rick Baker unless you're going to get him to do a good job?
No, I mean, he basically does what's called practical effects, meaning that the effect is literally right there before the camera. It's, you know, latex, or it's something that you can see, touch, and feel, and thus photograph. Whereas what the industry has moved towards is more of the Andy Serkis kind of effect, where it's all dots on somebody's face, and then, you know, it's motion capture, and all of a sudden you have a whole sea of apes in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, but yet there were no actual people dressed up in practical costumes.
Well, I'm hoping somewhere down the road when Tim Burton or somebody else needs something done right and they want a practical effect, that they're going to yank him out of retirement and say, no, you're not done yet.
And this story kind of broke on KPCC, which is a public radio station here in Los Angeles, because Rick Baker did an interview with KPCC out of Pasadena and talking about the fact that he was selling his, you know, warehouse full of, you know, old effects and old movie memorabilia. So that's really why
he should have started a museum. So now what is this? It's radio. Is that like a podcast where it just comes out at you whenever it wants?
Well, it's more like a podcast that is scheduled to appear on at a certain time on a certain,
and you have
radius
to listen to it or you miss it.
Correct. Yes.
Oh, okay.
That, and for those who may be of, say, a millennial generation, that's what that thing in your car is for.
Yeah. Next week we'll explain books, but keep moving.
Okay. Well, you know, speaking of which, we have some news about a podcast here. In fact, watch out, prosecuting attorneys. The Red Hot Podcast serial is coming back for 2 more seasons. They couldn't solve the crime this season, so they're going back.
Ouch.
To try and solve it again. Big deal or big whoop?
That's not what they're doing.
I know.
It's a big whoop, of course. Of course they're doing 2 more seasons. Like, good God. I mean, that goes without saying. They're doing research in 2 different stories. They're very different from the one that they did about the murder trial, I should say. And of course, the show was just a phenomenon. So of course it was coming back. But for the last 6 months, anytime anybody said, have you heard of the podcast? And I go, Serial. Like, how did you know I was going to say that? I'm like, because it's the only podcast anybody who doesn't know podcasts ever mentions. They're like, have you heard of this show? You know, you're like, Serial. Right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it was on the radio first. So I feel it's very disingenuous to call this a quote unquote podcast, because it was an NPR kind of serialized show that they kind of launched it on the radio and then let it go off into podcast land there.
So did one episode on radio and then the rest were podcasts?
I think you could hear every episode on the radio, frankly. But
those lying bastards.
I heard at least 3 episodes on the radio.
Those bastards.
And so when they were like, oh, it's the most popular podcast of all time, my feeling is, okay, why don't you try and mimic that? This time, avoid kind of forcing people to listen to it on the radio.
Well, but this Prairie Home Companion is available as a podcast. Lots of radio shows are available as podcasts, and it's still the most popular one of all time, right?
Good point. That's right. This American Life has a lot of listeners, but of course,
absolutely,
it's a radio show.
And it's available as a podcast.
And it's available. No, that's what I'm saying. It's a very popular podcast.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, okay. We're kind of vehemently agreeing with
that. Right, it's like arguing about what's a TV show. If it only appears on Netflix and it stars Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, it's still a TV show.
That's true. And in fact, if it's Orange is the New Black or House of Cards or I don't know, even...
Was that Netflix, right? That Lily Tomlin, that's Netflix or Amazon? I always forget.
Those are Netflix.
It's Netflix.
If it's The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt or Waltzing with Mozart, I think was the name of that show that I really liked on Amazon.
That's Amazon. Yeah. They're all TV shows.
Yeah. I mean, I try to... have a little willpower and watch them you know, at a deliberate pace, like one right after the other.
Ah, okay. Bring us to our next story.
In fact, just as NBC dives into this whole phenomenon called binge watching or binge viewing with its new David Duchovny drama Aquarius, Hollywood is reconsidering its love affair with dumping an entire season into viewers' laps all at once. Anticipation, the ability to be the center of water cooler talk, garnering media attention for 3 months rather than one day or one weekend, are all hot button reasons releasing a series all at once may not be ideal. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big natural progression.
Yeah.
You know, I think binge watching defines Netflix. That's where people go. There are all these old TV shows and they can watch seasons all at once. They can gobble up a whole series. You know, that's what they're known for. So for them, I think binge watching and putting a whole season available all at once, like House of Cards, that's definitive for them. That's you know, their defining trait. And I think that's a useful thing for them. But I think for a lot of shows, you're going to realize that there's a mix in there. Maybe some you'll do that. Maybe others, like comedies, they don't do well when you watch them all at once. You know, you can watch 12 comedies in a row, sitcoms, but that's not a great way to view them. So I think other shows will say, hey, maybe we should do it 2 or 3 episodes a week, you know, like for a sitcom or for some new drama, you know, that teases it out a little bit, lets people binge watch, but doesn't, you know, others will say we're a miniseries. Let's do one a night. You know, it's just, there's no rule. And I think you're going to find there's going to be mixes like this from now on, just like there are shows like Duchovny's Aquarius, which did not get great reviews. And they thought, hey, you know, we've got the whole show. It's done. And that doesn't often happen for networks. It's already finished before the first episode airs. So we have the option to make it available. And they did it for a limited time, thinking if you love to binge watch, you'll watch it. And if you like it, you'll tell people to check it out on the air. So it's all going to, you know, this whole mix, I think, is just the way it's going to be for the future. There's no right or wrong way. It's going to change for every show. It binge, you know, dumping the entire season all at once is not going to become the de facto standard, nor is teasing it out over 6 months.
You know, I like the whole concept of, you know what, it's here. You can watch the whole season right now for the next 3 weeks.
Yes.
And if you don't, by the way, it's gone. So at least for a period of time. It's like concerts. You know, you either go see the concert when the band is in town or you miss them.
But, you know, half the time when you have a conversation about a hot TV show, all anybody says, shut up, I haven't seen it. I haven't watched it. I haven't seen it.
You know? Listen, I don't know what you're talking about, but if you're going down this Mad Men road, I told you last week, I have not seen the final episode yet.
To teach the world.
No, hey, I'm not listening. I don't know why you're singing that song.
Buy the world a Coke.
Well, you buy them a Coke while you stop singing that song and telling me about Mad Men. How about that?
All right.
Okay. Instead, tell me about 50 Shades of Grey. Because E.L. James is, she is the author of the mega-selling erotica series 50 Shades of Grey, and she is putting out a new book, well, sort of. It's called Grey, and there's no more 50 Shades, you get that? It tells the same story from the point of view of Christian Grey, and given James's start in self-publishing, the book was announced on June 1st and comes out immediately on June 18th. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal for their publisher.
That's true.
It's the same story told from his point of view. It's brilliant. It's, you know, it's like she's not exactly pushing into new territory yet, but more power to her. You know, fans want to read it. They kept begging her for it. She said, yeah, it's a good idea. So, you know,
the publisher,
I'm sure it'll be just as well reviewed as the other books and sell just as many copies.
Well, weren't you, didn't you tell me about overhearing E.L. James' publisher at Book Expo of America talking to her about and asking, you know, about whether Christian Grey had a butler or a maid or other people that they could tell the story from their point of view?
Oh, okay. I get your joke now. Okay.
Fans of the reboot of Tron, unlike E.L. James, Tron is going in a different direction. Because fans of that series, all two of them, they will have to wait for a reboot of the reboot. Disney had pulled the plug. They've pulled the plug now on Tron 3, to which I say, wait, was there a Tron 2, actually? I guess there was a Tron 2. But in fact, they mean a sequel to the 2010 film Tron Legacy, which was Tron 2. You know, if you start counting with the reboot, it's Tron 2 or it's Tron 3. I don't know. You know what? Where do you start? Do you start with Tron from back in 1982 or the Tron from 2010?
I didn't understand it. I don't know. It's not Tron 3. It's Tron 2. I mean, the film was made 30 years after the first one. So, no, it was not Tron 3. I mean, that's stupid. I mean, Tron Legacy continued the story or whatever, but come on.
Well, look, you know what? Forget about that. If those numbers confuse you, just stick to these numbers. Tron Legacy cost $200 million to make and grossed $400 million worldwide. So that kind of explains that. Big deal or big whoop?
Big Whoop. What I cannot believe is the amount of attention that this got. I mean, that
either.
Movie came out in 2010. It's 5 years later. Who the hell cares? Who the hell was waiting for it? It's been dead for ages. And yet somehow everybody covered this. It was on Rolling Stone's website. It was on. It's like the need for like to put anything up. It could not be more better typified than the fact that a flop film does not have a sequel that nobody is waiting for.
A flop film based on a film from 30 years
that was a
prior.
Flop.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't understand. Heaven's Gate 2 didn't work?
Yeah, yeah, go exactly. Figure. They're not going to make Heaven's Gate 3? I can't believe it. It only came out 7 years ago.
Now, pop star Iggy Azalea is canceling her arena tour.
Well,
it has nothing to do with the slow ticket sales. I mean,
maybe it doesn't.
Not that there are ticket sales that are slow, because it has nothing to do with that, of course. I mean, ticket sales are ticket sales, and they're not slow. We're not saying that. It's just that she's canceling her tour. Azalea insists she's been on a crazy treadmill, and she wants to take a break, like when she took a break and delayed her tour last year. She wants to figure out a new direction for her sound. You know, maybe a good one, and so on and so forth.
You don't like Azalea?
Azalea was going to promote her second album with the tour, but the album has been pushed back to 2016. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, you know, she had one album, and she has three top 10 hits. So touring arenas, even if your new second album had come out, seems too soon, too fast to me. It's like, you don't have enough songs to play. And so I thought that was too much too soon. However, you know, it was supposed to promote the second album. The album's been delayed, so it only makes sense that they delay the tour. So, I mean, they shouldn't have called it canceling. They should just, well, they put tickets on sale, and then they pulled them. Apparently, there's tension backstage. There's a lot of money to be made. She's a big rising star, and, you know, there's fighting between her and the label and the management. Everybody's at each other's throats, it seems like. And, you know, stepping back for a while may be a great idea, but there seems to be a power struggle going on here. Some people leak stories to the LA Times saying, oh, yeah, ticket sales weren't good enough for an arena tour. Well, so what? Of course they weren't. She only had one album and three top 10 hits. You shouldn't have booked her in arenas. And then other people said, no. And Forbes, they said her tickets were actually going for a really high price on secondary markets, meaning there was a lot of demand for them. So I don't know what's true as far as tickets.
Well, they were going for saying they may have been priced really high on secondary markets.
That's true.
It doesn't
I thought
mean
of
they
that
were
too.
Sold.
That's true. But, it looked like they were, our Forbes was arguing that they were, you know, having good demand. So who knows? Higher than Foo Fighters, but not as high as Fleetwood Mac. That's how they described it. But who knows? Yeah, exactly. You can price anything for anything. It doesn't mean it's going to sell.
Well,
but,
let's
album
review.
Was delayed. So of course the tour should have been delayed. And what's been screwed up here is that they made it into a big, Meshuggah, instead of just saying, well, we're going to promote the new album and the album's been delayed, so sorry guys, you'll just have to wait a little while longer. Well, instead, they make it sound like this big traumatic moment and, oh, I'm rethinking my sound and all this. I was like, no, just the album's delayed, so the tour's delayed. But that's a problem with the people that she's got behind her, and maybe she needs to look twice at them.
Well, there's always some kind of like kerfuffle going on around her. Have you noticed that?
No, not really. I don't.
There's always some fight or some dispute that she's having with some rapper somewhere. I don't know.
Oh, well, there you go.
I don't know. I've never kind of listened to it. I never.
Three top 10 singles, you should not be in an arena. Even if you can, you should not be in an arena. That's just not a good way to build a career.
No, I mean, look at how
unless you think you're a flash in the pan and this is your only chance, that is not what you should do.
Look at how long it took Mumford & Sons to do an arena tour, their third album, before they did an arena tour. They did.
Well, and they build up slowly. Yeah, they did clubs, the smaller, the medium, you know, go through the chain. There's a good reason why that exists.
That's right. They did do big venues like the Hollywood Bowl, but still, they didn't play. Maybe they did play Madison Square. I'm going to eat all these words, I'm sure. But thankfully, that's the end of Big Deal or Big Whoop and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, Michael, last week you were at Book Expo of America and BookCon. I have one question for both shows. What are they?
Well, that's easy. The Book Expo of America is the largest gathering in North America for the publishing industry. That's where you get editors and writers and publicists and marketers and bookstore owners and independent bookstore owners and librarians and all the backroom people that help make all this stuff work. They all come together and they talk to each other. And
is that what Hollywood calls the little people?
No. It's big people.
Okay,
Simon
just checking.
Schuster, Penguin Random House. It's big, little, medium-sized people.
Okay.
And they all get together and they have meetings and they network and they get each other jazzed up about all the books that are coming out in the spring, summer, and fall. you know, that all the books coming out for the next year, they get them all excited about it. And there are authors there and they do signings and there are panels and all that sort of stuff. So Book Expo is when the industry talks to itself. BookCon is when the industry tries to talk to the world. They're reaching out to fans, to actual readers. So it's an event open to the public, just like Comic-Con. It's kind of like Comic-Con's smarter kid brother.
Oh, it's like Comic-Con with glasses. I get it.
Well, Comic-Cons are always picked as nerds, right? So I don't think that's fair.
But I knew as I was saying that, I thought, oh my God, he's going to totally get me on this whole comic book thing, isn't he? Right. And sure enough, you did.
Right. So the Book Expo, it's weird. You know, it's been a real transition. I've been going for a number of years. It felt very quiet this year. They say attendance was the same and blah, blah, blah. Everything was fine. But I was walking the aisles and it was easy. Some years, you know, you couldn't push your way through the aisles and it felt really crowded. This year, it didn't at all. China had a huge presence. China had like the biggest display there by a factor of 10, it seemed like. It was this monster, multiple areas with massive displays of books that have been published in China, like, you know, big blockbuster books from here published in China, or Chinese books that they're hoping to bring to the rest of the world. And it was impressive, but they'd have like a huge sort of a plaza with fake grass and a little tree in the middle. And then it was like walking into like a little Tiananmen Square. There's this big open space, like in the middle of an expo where there's tons of booths and millions of people crammed in. It'd be this little wide open plaza. And there's nobody in there because there's nothing really to do in there. And you kind of walk and you feel like you're, you know,
everybody's looking at you.
Yeah, you're tiptoeing into this quiet little area. And then there's another one and then another one and then another one. And then they had their own stage where they had panels about China and censorship, but people were upset that the Chinese publishers had such a big area when there wasn't enough focus on the censorship on the publishing industry and things like that. But it was a big, massive, impressive statement that we are here and you need to do business with us. No question about that.
Well, now, there were several big galleys that were the talk of the BEA.
Well, there's like The City on Fire, which is this big book coming from a young author. It's one of the hottest books in years, and it's about New York in the 70s, and everybody's crazy about that. It got a big deal, and it was there, and people, of course, wanted to get their hands on it. They wanted to get their hands on the new Brian Selznick book. That's the guy who did The Invention of
Hugo Cabret.
That's right. So that was a big one to get. But frankly, this year, as I've seen in the last few years, there just wasn't that craze for galleys anymore because people can get them online. I would walk through the Book Expo and I'd see a poster for a book that I wanted to read coming out in September, October. And I'd go online to see if it was available on one of the sites that the industry uses. And if it was, I'd request it or I could get it right away if I was pre-approved. So, you know, that's what you do. I mean, unless a book is some physical object that you really want to hold in your hands, like a picture book or Brian Selznick book, which is sort of a combo graphic novel type, you know, it's got major illustrations in it. So unless it's something like that where you really need to hold it, you don't need a galley. You don't need to go into a frenzy to try and get that actual physical copy because it's your only chance to read it and you can know whether it's good and whether you want to buy 100 copies for your store or 1,000 copies for your store. You know, getting those galleys used to be, you know, important because it was a source of info that you couldn't get anywhere else. Nowadays, it's just not that frenzy. So I guess there were a few people with rolling suitcases behind them, you know, because they would fill up their suitcase, take it back to the hotel, dump them out, come back, get more galleys. That's not happening anymore.
Well, you know, what I liked was what I heard that Dan Marshall, the author of Home is Burning, what he said, this is a memoir about he's
a member of the Talking Heads.
I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah.
Keep going.
He is, you know, Dan Marshall. Home is Burning is the title. It's about his he's caring for his ill parents while, you know, at the same time, he's kind of fighting with all of his brothers and sisters. He unveiled a new blurb for his book. It was written by his own mother. And I'm going to kind of make this a little bit more politer for our listeners and on our family show. It was F you, Danny, and F your book. That was his mother.
That's awesome. I didn't see that at all. So the Book Expo was a little sleepy. For me, BookCon was a lot more exciting because I've been wondering for 10 or 20 years why they didn't imitate Comic-Con and do it for books. Last year, about 10,000 people showed up. It was kind of a mess. They didn't really know what to do. The publishers were scared. They're like, what? Readers here? You know, they didn't know what to do about it. They were frightened and they ran away, literally ran away, and nobody was there. This year, about 18,000 people showed up. They just released the info. So that's an 80% increase. And of course, the floor space could accommodate a lot more, but, you know, baby steps. And they had you know, some movie screenings or footage from Paper Towns, the John Green film. And they had screenings of Room based on the Emma Donoghue novel and some other stuff. They had stars like Mindy Kaling and BJ Novak and Jason Segel, who has a picture book out. And, you know, and of course,
and
all
Jerry
the big
Seinfeld. Book. Didn't Jerry Seinfeld? I mean, what I thought was interesting was
I don't think he was at the book con. No,
maybe not. I don't know. But I did find it interesting that they had all these panel discussions with these movie stars and television stars.
Well, I do feel that the people behind book con are, and I think it's a problem a little bit with Comic Con. It's like, you know, if you want to have a movie con, have a movie con. If you want a TV con, have a TV con. When you've got authors like Judy Blume and Stephen King and James Patterson and John Green and, you know, Diana Gabaldon and Nora Roberts and all these superstars, they're going to have people lined up to see them. You don't have, you know, you don't have to have big movies at everything just to pull people in. You know, they want to see these authors. And I think because of publishing, they do a lot fewer tours now than they used to. They just don't fund tours the way they used to. People do like video tours and they Skype tour and things like that. I think a series of book cons 4 times a year around the country is a great way for authors to reach. There's always new books coming out. And there's always movies and TV shows based on books that have a new season or a new, you know, or premiere coming out. So 4 times a year, different parts of the U.S., East Coast, West Coast, North and South. To me, it's a no-brainer. I think it should be done. I think if there are movies and TV shows to tie in, great, or Broadway shows. Like you say, half the shows on Broadway are based on books. You've got Hamilton, the hot new musical coming out in the fall. That drew on material and credited. I don't think it's an official adaptation, but it certainly credited the recent biography of Hamilton as a source of information. So that's a great tie-in. But, you know, you've got big authors and big books. They've got their fans. All you got to do is bring them together.
So now, what does this mean for our listeners?
If you're in Chicago, BookCon may be coming to Chicago next year. That's what they're saying. They're going to have a 1-day BookCon next year in Chicago because that's where the Book Expo of America will be next year. It's usually in New York, but next year it'll be in Chicago. So if you're anywhere near there next year, you have a chance to go to BookCon and check it out and maybe see some of your favorite authors and get galleys of some books and things like that.
Or, as you like to say, it's in Chicago next year. Gosh darn it.
Right, exactly, because I won't be going. So,
but you just told me you don't need to, because basically you go around going, why are all these people here in this galleys?
BookCon I like. Oh, okay. The Book Expo, I saw less of a need to grab galleys and things like that.
Okay.
And it did seem a little sleepy. But for BookCon, it's your only chance to see an author, and you get to see him in person. You get to touch him. I went to BookCon. I interviewed John Green. You know, that was fun. A lot of people were excited by that. And his panel was crazy. There were so many people. So, yeah, you know, I think it's a fun thing. I think reaching out and seeing authors and getting to hear them and see them in person is a real thrill for people. So if BookCon succeeds the way Comic-Con does, and it's going to be a long process before that happens, because Comic-Con reaches like more than 100,000 people when they happen in San Diego and in New York City. You're looking at 110, 120, 150,000 attendees. So, you know, that's 10 times the size of what BookCon.
I don't think it'll ever get there. You know why?
Why?
Nobody reads.
That's not true. It is true, though, however, that ebook sales were down. We talk a lot about ebooks on the show, don't we?
Yes, we do, actually.
Yeah, and according to Nielsen, they surveyed 30 top retailers, and of course, this does not include Amazon, because Amazon's the biggest seller of ebooks, but we don't know how much they're selling. You know, if all the individual publishers would fess up, we could add it all up together, but that's not going to happen. But the fact is that in 2014, ebook sales slowed down a little bit. They were 26% of all book sales, meaning units. You know, like you sold a million copies of something, 26% of them were an ebook. That's sort of a, you know, a rough idea. But 26% of all book sales were in the ebook format. That's down from 2013, when 28% of all book sales were in the ebook format. So what's going on?
I think that people don't read.
Well, it's a huge industry. More money is spent on books each year than at the movies, going to the movie theaters. But of course, and that doesn't even include like textbooks and manuals and things like that. We're just talking about commercial books that you buy in a bookstore, like cookbooks and picture books and fiction and biography. Stuff like that is a huge market. But of course, there's a lot more books put out than there are movies. So more people probably go see one movie than read most books. You know, one movie can be seen by 7 million people, 10 million people. That's a big hit. Most books are not read by 7 or 10 million. Some are, but most are read by a couple hundred thousand or 50,000 or, you know, 200,000 or a million. And that's a great big success for a book.
We just buy them to put on our bookshelves so that when people come over, they go, wow, you are really smart.
Right. But, you know, people say, oh, ebooks have slowed down. I think two things are happening. One is that e-readers were a huge success, and they've gotten supplanted, unfortunately, by tablets. People said, I've got a tablet like an iPad. Why buy an e-reader? But the fact is, it's a lot easier to read on an e-reader than a tablet, and you don't get distracted by other stuff. And I highly encourage people to buy e-readers because I think they're great. And I just think it's a better way to read, and you'll do more of it if you have it. When you got your tablet, suddenly you're surfing, you're checking your email, you get a text. So, you know, they decide they don't need an e-reader. They have got their tablet, but the tablet isn't as easy to read on, and it's more distractible, so you do less reading on it.
And that is
so
why that is the reason, I think, that I have not finished a book since the iPad was released, frankly.
Did you have an e-reader, like a Kindle?
It was a joke. Really?
Okay. Well, I don't know. Maybe you don't read. However, there's a little help because of the phablet. People not only are people more distracted on the tablet, but they don't carry them with them everywhere anymore. They're not as enamored with them, but they do have their phablet with them everywhere, which is a large smartphone. And that actually, unlike the phone, is really conducive to reading. It's almost as big as an e-reader. It's pretty, you know, it's got a great screen. And while you're just as distracted, you have that with you 24/7. Unlike the tablet and unlike the e-reader, you have that with you all the time. And I think that could help again, bring ebook back online. I think it's just a natural pause in the growth. I don't think it's a sign that ebooks are, you know, have peaked already because it's just too natural. And keep this in mind, 51% of all fiction sales were in the ebook format. So
half
of all book sales were in ebook in North America. When you're talking fiction, romance, mystery, fantasy, sci-fi, all of that was above 50% in sales. That's adult fiction we're talking about. We're not talking about picture books and
juvenile. Now, 99% of that 51% was romance.
No. I mean, mystery is huge in ebook. Fantasy and sci-fi is huge in ebook. No. All the genre fiction is incredibly strong in ebook. And it just doesn't make any sense. I was walking down the street from Book Expo. I needed a book. I wanted to read one of John Green's books because I was going to interview him the next day or 2 days later. And I checked. They had a copy at the Strand bookstore. They had a copy at Barnes & Noble, but I could get it cheaper as an ebook right away. And so I did.
And that right there is exactly why record stores no longer exist.
Yeah.
Because it was always cheaper to buy the record or the CD online than it was it was always cheaper to steal it online, which is what most people wound up doing.
For a while. But nowadays they just buy it or they stream it. Yeah.
If you're a U2 fan, you know, they're just giving that away.
Right. Print is not going anywhere because there are too many types of books that you want to hold in your hand, like a picture book. Even if it works on a tablet, it's just not the same for a little kid. Or a cookbook. There are advantages sometimes to e-versions of that, but a lot of it you put on your kitchen counter, you splatter it with sauce, it doesn't matter. Art book, coffee table books, photography, you know, textbooks with a lot of illustrations and things. All that stuff works really well in a physical hard copy. But a lot of it, text-based fiction, text-based books, fiction, nonfiction, sports, biography, why the heck, you know, of course it'll keep going. So I think it's just a natural pause.
Speaking of pausing, we now pause to let you
know. To say goodbye.
To say goodbye to some people, actually, who are no longer with us, including Dennis Sheehan. Now, if you don't know who Dennis Sheehan is...
And I didn't.
He's kind of a well-known tour manager. He was with U2 for over 30 years, 33 years, I believe. He had a sudden heart attack in the midst of a massive New World tour that U2 was on. Right here in Los Angeles, he died at what he considered his home away from home, actually, the Sunset Marquee, ironically just a few, like a block or two away from the Roxy Theater where U2 performed Thursday night. So I guess that's why, you know, it's not ironic because they were in town.
And dedicated a song to him, of course.
He joined U2 before they released War, but they were already kind of an acclaimed for their debut album and they were well known as a live act.
But they hadn't exploded yet at all way they were
about to. No, not like after the Joshua Tree.
Well, no.
And this, you know, let's face it, U2, that's where they spend most of their time is on the road. And it's where most of the band, you know, where most bands these days make money is on the road. I mean, he had worked with Led Zeppelin, for instance. So he was a pretty well-known tour manager.
And I don't think people realize how significant they are. I mean, it's of course a specialized skill, but they're with him 24/7, and he's making the area where they make their most money happen. And it's like D-Day, you know, running a concert tour like this for a big major act. That is so logistically intense, and it's so unique that there's just only a handful of people who can handle it and do it, you know, and it's hard skill to learn. So the importance of this guy to their career and the work that they do and make it happen and run smoothly so that all these shows go off well and people don't even think about it and just, I love the band. You know, he's a really significant part of their success, and they're going to miss him.
Yes, not only be, you know, on a personal level, but on a professional one. And certainly when you look at what U2 has been able to do with their last several tours, whether it was Pop Mart, where they had that big giant screen for that arena tour, that stadium tour, or the stadium tour, they did the 360 with that big giant set. They
and
had
the zoo tour, and this tour is getting great reviews too, as far as the way that's being done, you know, logistically.
Yeah, I'm going to see it tomorrow. I mean, it's just, these are huge tours. That are, as you say, Michael, logistically very complicated, with hopscotching stages that, you know, one stage gets struck while the other one is being set up and go, you know, it's just, it's pretty remarkable. He was 68 years old and still doing the job. And I think it was probably just a little bit too much for him.
I wouldn't say that. Who knows why? He just had a heart attack. I don't think it was too much. I don't think he was overwhelmed by the work. He just had a bad heart.
Well, maybe, you know.
He could have lived to be 80 and do it 80. You know, good heavens.
No, but I mean,
blame it
on
the workload.
If you have a bad heart and you've got that much, I mean, it's a stressful job.
I don't blame it on the work.
All right, fine.
He just had a bad heart. You know, I'm sure if he had any health issues, they would have taken care of him, you know.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, nobody's going to. All right, anyway, Wally Castle is also dead. He's an actor, and he played a gangster pal of Jimmy Cagney in White Heat. And he died at 103. And my immediate thought was, I've never heard of him. But I thought, dear God, somebody from White Heat is still alive?
Yeah, that's
I mean, that was awesome. He's survived by his relatively youthful wife, Marcy McGuire, who's only 89 years old. So God bless her. I hope she's around for many years to come. But, you know, he married her many, many years ago. Mickey Rooney was his best man. And Mickey Rooney could never figure out how they stayed married. Like, he had like 20 wives. He's like, why are you guys still married? It must be the red hair. Because Marcy has red hair. So, you know, a good actor, steady worker. He also starred in some good noir like Quicksand and The City That Never Sleeps. And now he's gone.
And so is Jim Bailey, a female impersonator who struck it big. What?
And now he's dead at 77 years old.
Okay. I'm looking at this.
A female impersonator who struck it big. He's dead at 77.
Okay.
It's all my fault. It's all my fault.
There's some words missing in that obituary. But he sang and performed as iconic female stars. I mean,
Judy Garland, Barbara Streisand, Phyllis Diller, people like that.
But the funny thing is, not funny, but the interesting thing is Judy Garland actually loved his performance of her.
Oh yeah, I mean, and was a friend to him and mentored him. Yeah, no, he really was an artist. I mean, there are people who do shtick or make, you know, do big broad sort of impersonations. This guy would only do one impersonation of performance. Because it took him hours to perfect the look and to get into character. And so if he was doing Judy, he wasn't going to do Judy Garland and then Barbara Streisand. You know, that was just mimicry or some stunt. What he did was really perform in the spirit of those people. And they, I mean, he worked with Lucille Ball playing when he played Phyllis Diller. He did Judy Garland on the Ed Sullivan Show. He did Barbara Streisand with Carol Burnett. I mean, you know, he was a real artist. I vaguely remember his face when I see it, but you know, as far as turning female impersonation into a long-standing career and getting to work with the actual talent that you admire, it's kind of a neat little thing. He worked with Liza Minnelli playing her mom. I mean, that's kind of crazy, but obviously, you know, he knew and loved her mom, and so Liza worked with him, and she did mother-daughter duets with Jim Bailey playing her mother. I mean, it's crazy.
Well, now, speaking of working with those you're impersonating, and you too, check out, you know, you can see there's like probably a dozen videos on YouTube of the first show that U2 did in Los Angeles at the Forum. They pulled a Bono impersonator up on stage who is a dead ringer for Bono. And they sang together. They did like a duet on The Sweetest Thing. And it was like, it was perfect. He looked like the guy. He sang like the guy. He was a better Bono than Bono. Look it up. You'll see what I mean.
Nobody could be a better Bono than Bono.
Well, I'm sure he would say that. But you know what I would say, actually, is I told you that if you stuck around, we'd tell you something about 3D and 40, the 40% mark.
Oh, no, we need to do it. That's right.
But why don't we do this? Why don't we tease the show for next week with our listener email that we will read next week?
Okay.
And it's a very interesting email from...
Slap Michael in the face email.
Ooh, from if that doesn't get people listening, then nothing will.
It's, oh my God, they're going to slap back on the face. It'll be the highest viewership yet.
Yes, CJ Flynn wrote the email, and we will be reading it next on next week's show. But in the meantime, you know what you can do? You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free, or even where you pay for them. You can usually find our show. And if you can't, please let us know. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, we do ask that you subscribe to the show. It does help us out when you do. You can find...
Rate and review.
Yeah, rating and reviewing the show also helps us out. But you
does
can...
subscribing help, too?
Yeah, I guess, you know, because then, you know, Apple or whoever it is looks and goes, hey, yeah, this show is popular. Let's feature it. But, you know, whether you're rating and reviewing the show, subscribing to the show, you're trying to find links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode, or you're looking for those ways to contact us, that can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all of our social network accounts. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle there, or you can like us on Facebook. You can search for Showbiz Sandbox, and we have a page on Facebook. Again, all of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their own website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's CaitlinLooksPrettyDamnGood.com.
You know what? I'll leave it at that and also say that if you can't find any of Michael's work on that particular website, which I'm sure is now already taken, you know, you can probably head on over to MichaelGiltz.com or the Huffington Post or bookfilter.com. And that's where you can find all of Michael's work on either the publishing industry or the entertainment industry. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.